Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hugh LaFollette, Professor of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University. My guest this evening is Neil Shanks, also from the Department of Philosophy at ETSU, and we're going to be discussing why evolution is true. Glad to have you with us, Professor Shanks.
Hi, good afternoon.
Okay, let's begin by talking a little bit about what exactly the theory of evolution is. What is the theory of evolution? What is it that it tries to explain?
The theory of evolution is essentially targeted at providing a scientific explanation of three or four different types of phenomena. The first phenomenon that it is interested in is the origins of life, the transition from non-living chemical reactions to biochemical reactions characteristic of organisms. The second phenomenon it tries to explain is what is known as microevolution. This is evolutionary change within a species. And then, of course, there is the big issue, the origin of species itself, which is a problem in the domain of macroevolution. And the theory of evolution tries to explain the origin of species. There is a fourth issue, which the theory also provides a very good explanation of, and that is the evolution of complexity. What we notice as we study the evolution of life on Earth is increasing complexity, the human brain, of course, being the most complex of structures we know in the known universe. And the theory of evolution provides a very good explanation of the evolution of such complexity.
Well, actually, that's a good place to jump off for me to ask the next question, because you're talking about complexity, and certainly the brain is complex. Sometimes when people talk about the human body, they talk about the complexity of the eye. A number of people find it very hard to understand how evolution could, in fact, provide an explanation for such complex organisms, since most people think of evolution as being primarily a random process. And how can a random process lead to something so complex as the human brain or the human eye? What does the evolutionist say to this question?
I think the evolutionist is usually knocked on his back by the colossal misunderstanding this claim of randomness that it involves. Evolution is not a random process. Evolution contains an element of randomness in the form of genetic mutation, but it also contains the deterministic process of natural selection. And what results is not a random process, but a process of trial and error. So when, for example, Sir Fred Hoyle and Chandra Vikram Singh make the allegation that evolution is like a whirlwind going through a junkyard to assemble a 747, a Boeing 747, they completely misunderstand the issues at hand. Far from being random, we have variation within a population of organisms provided by mutation, and natural selection acts upon that variation. Let me give you a very simple example. Let us suppose a mutation occurs that enables a zebra to run a little bit faster than the other zebras in the population. The probability is now enhanced that that zebra will be able to evade predators better than the other members of the population and will live long enough to mate and pass on more of its genes to the next generation. Slower zebras, unfortunately, will be eaten and weeded out of the gene pool. So it's not a random process at all. It's quite deterministic, and there's nothing surprising about how natural selection operates.
Okay, so there really are two important parts of the process. One is random, namely the process of mutation. The other is not, namely natural selection, if you described it, so that when people say that evolution is just a random process, they're simply looking at half of the story of evolution.
Yes, if you only tell half of the story, you'll find it very puzzling and very silly. Luckily, as Paul Harvey sometimes says, I'm here to tell you the other half of the story, the bit that's usually missed out.
Okay. Now, eventually I want to come back and talk about some of the other concerns which creationists often raise about evolution, but one thing I think it would be helpful for the listeners is for you to talk about the practical applications of evolution. I mean, sometimes when we people hear about the theory of evolution, they think it's sort of a quaint theory, or perhaps a not-so-quaint theory that biologists discuss, but a theory that has no practical applications. Does the theory of evolution have practical applications? Does it make any difference to the way we live?
I think it does. The place where you're going to find the most abundantly clear practical consequences of evolution are in the domain of medicine. And we can trace out evolution's consequences with respect to some quite interesting phenomena. For example, the evolution of drug-resistant bacteria. Bacteria, they have a generation time of about 20 minutes. And that means that a population of bacteria can evolve in a week as much as human beings might in, say, 10,000 years, because our generation time is much longer. And what we have discovered in our hospitals are the presence of what are known as nosocomial infections. These are illnesses acquired by patients as a result of being in hospital. And one of the things that has happened in the last 40 or 50 years is the emergence of drug-resistant bacteria. Indeed, we've got some bacteria now that have evolved to feed on antibiotics as well as certain types of disinfectant. And it's a growing problem, and it's a problem recognized by the medical community. And unfortunately, it's evolution in action.
Okay, and so your claim is it would be hard to understand this phenomenon without the theory of evolution?
It makes absolutely no sense without the theory of evolution, because to understand the emergence of drug-resistant strains, you have to understand the appearance of mutations that enable bacteria to thrive in this new antibiotic-laden environment.
Okay, so even there, at the level of bacteria, what you see is this combination of mutation and natural selection.
That's right. Mutations occur, and those that enable the bacteria to thrive in an antibiotic-laden environment are those that will be naturally selected to propagate in that environment. And, of course, those with mutations that are deleterious will be weeded out.
Okay. Are there any other examples in medicine or elsewhere, sort of practical applications of evolution?
You really can't make much sense of biomedical phenomena in either humans or animals without an understanding of the theory of evolution. There are many phenomena I can mention that are consequent upon human evolution. One of the ones that will be perhaps most familiar to your listeners will be frequent problems that are occasioned by lower back pain. The curvature in the lumbar region needed for an upright posture is also a source of problems with lower back pain, slip discs, and so forth. The upright posture has also brought about pressure on the veins in the anus, around the anus, and in the legs. And this has led to hemorrhoid problems, varicose veins. Our Stone Age ancestors lived in a low cholesterol environment. The body needs cholesterol, and they evolved mechanisms to hoard cholesterol. Unfortunately, our environment has changed with the big socioeconomic changes we've seen in the late 20th century, and we now live in an environment that is essentially laden with cholesterol. And what was once an advantage for us, the ability to hoard cholesterol, has now come back to haunt us, with the form of rocketing rates of heart disease. There are many, many phenomena of this nature. The difficulties that women experience in childbirth, for example. To be able to walk successfully, the pelvis can only be so large. But with the rapid evolution of the human brain, requires now a large head to protect that brain, and it makes for difficult births. Births that are more difficult than the ones that we would observe, for example, in other mammals.
Okay, so what you want to say is all these are examples of well-recognized medical phenomenon that, I mean, it's not just that doctors are aware of, but that most people on the street would be aware of, and that they really can't be explained well except in the theory of evolution.
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, if that's so, why is it that so many people appear to be opposed to or concerned about the theory of evolution? I mean, what you're telling me is that they're very good, practical implications of the theory of evolution. Very important for human health. And it looks as if doctors would recognize this, biologists would recognize it, and that they would tell the public. What's the source of confusion, do you think?
Well, I think that this is such a big issue where one could really devote a whole radio show to this issue alone, but let me make some brief comments.
Okay.
First of all, I think that declining standards in science education have left us with a general public that is not properly able to think clearly and critically about the difference between science and, for example, creationist science, which is really a branch of pseudoscience. So they're not very well able to see the difference between science and pseudoscience. It's a political issue. All sorts of, I think, right-wing political groups now have an ideological stake in ensuring that the theory of evolution is not taught in schools properly, as we saw in the recent debate on the Birx-Whitson bill, to fire teachers who taught properly, as they should, that evolution has a factual basis. And I think in the final analysis, one cannot ignore the fact that biology has become the place where the dispute between religion and science is currently fought. In the time of Copernicus and Galileo, it was physics. Today, it's biology.
Okay. Let's pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who may be joining us late. I'm Hugh LaFollette. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest this evening is Neil Shanks, professor of philosophy at ETSU, and we're discussing why he says evolution is true. Let's go back to one of the first things you said. You talked about the theory of evolution providing explanations for four phenomena. The origin of life itself, intraspecific variation, variation within species, and then the emergence of species, and lastly, complexity. The third one, though, it strikes me as a really interesting one because that's the one that people, I think, have the hardest time understanding or appreciating, how it is that the processes of mutation and natural selection can lead to the emergence of new species. Is the idea that evolution can produce species simply a theoretical construct? Is it something that biologists cooked up in their sitting in their offices? Or is there some real evidence that new species can emerge through evolutionary process?
We have, I think, a lot of good evidence. I like to think of the evidence concerning the emergence of new species as perhaps one of the best-kept secrets in biology. Speciation has been directly observed, contrary to what creationists claim, on numerous occasions. It can happen by several means. In plants, we have the phenomenon of polyploidy, which involves a doubling of chromosome number or tripling of chromosome number, and this can lead to a new species of plants appearing within one generation. There is also the well-documented evidence of the emergence of assortative mating, and this is believed to be a precursor to speciation, and we've seen it in fruit flies on numerous occasions in fruit fly populations. One of my favorite cases concerns a polychaete worm, Neri's acuminosta, in which we saw directly in laboratory and field studies the emergence of speciation in the form of reproductive isolation over a period of about 20 years. We have to use short-lived species because, obviously, for human beings, art is long and life is short. But to say that speciation has never been directly observed is simply false.
Okay. So you're saying that provides at least very strong evidence for the theory of evolution. Let me ask, though, in reading creationist literature, one of the concerns they have, and there are many, but certainly one of the concerns they have, concerns the interpretation of the fossil record. Evolutionists normally point to fossils as evidence for for the occurrence of evolution, creationists tend to deny that the fossils actually show that evolution occurred. Could you explain briefly what their criticism is, what you take their criticism to be, and whether you think it's a telling criticism?
Well, I think that the principal criticism springs from a misunderstanding of the fossil record. And this is perhaps best illustrated by looking at the case of a fossil known as Archaeopteryx. This is believed to be a fossil which is a transitional form between reptiles and birds. The theory of evolution leads us to expect that Archaeopteryx will have a mixture of characteristics. It will have some characteristics from reptiles, and it will have some characteristics from birds, but it won't have, if you like, partial characteristics from both reptiles and birds. Let me illustrate what I mean. We will expect Archaeopteryx to have what it does have, which are feathers, which are, of course, an avian characteristic. We expect Archaeopteryx to have some reptilian characters. Well, it has teeth, which are reptilian characters. And so we expect it to have some characters from the reptiles and some characters from the birds. We expect to see a mix of characters. Creationists, however, misunderstand what a transitional form is. They insist that Archaeopteryx must have partial characters. It must have partial feathers, partial teeth, partial wings, and so on. And this is not what we expect from the standpoint of the theory of evolution. And of course, I've never had a creationist satisfactorily explain whether with all these partial characteristics, as opposed to the mixture, whether Archaeopteryx would also have to lay partial eggs and hatch out partial chicks.
Okay. Let's go back to something else, too. I mean, you've talked about the theory of evolution as if all biologists believed exactly the same thing about the theory of evolution. But isn't there disagreement among scientists?
Of course there's disagreement. That's what science thrives on. Science isn't a body of fixed scriptural dogma. Science is an open-ended quest for knowledge. People disagree with each other all the time. It's through the resolution of those differences and disagreements that science grows and flourishes. Stifle disagreement, you stifle science. I must say, though, that one of the unfortunate things about this is that creationists pick up on disagreement, and then they say that scientists are just like a bunch of scribes and scriptural specialists quibbling over dogma when the reverse is true. It is, in fact, through disagreement over the interpretation of evidence, as opposed to scripture, that science advances. So disagreement is precisely what you expect in a healthy branch of science. And we see lots of disagreement in evolution. It's a sign of its health.
Well, I mean, doesn't it show, though, that evolution is just a theory? I mean, wasn't that sort of the purpose of the Birx-Whitson bill?
I don't think it shows that it's just a theory at all, and for good reason. Large parts of the theory of evolution are agreed upon. Where you see the disagreements are on the frontiers, where knowledge is being pushed forward and we're advancing the frontiers of knowledge. But most of the theory of evolution is a matter of community consensus. For example, we all agree that evolution has occurred, that all life forms have a common ancestor in the distant past. There is no disagreement there. There are disagreements on the precise mechanisms of evolution, for sure, but that's as it should be. There are disagreements, for example, if I may shift the territory from biology to physics. There are disagreements over the interpretation of relativity theory. But believe you me, nobody in the town of Hiroshima in 1945 would have said of E equals MC squared, golly, it's just a theory. Not at all.
Okay, so part of the problem has to do with an understanding about what the term theory means.
Yes, theories predict, describe, and explain evidence, things that we've observed. Newton's theory of gravity describes, predicts, and explains gravitational phenomena. The theory of evolution describes, predicts, and explains the facts of biology. Theories predict, describe, and explain facts. You can't, so to speak, picture theories at one end and facts at the other. It would be a complete misconception of the nature of science.
Okay. Now, since we're talking about science and we've talked a little bit about creationism, what is the view of creationist science, and is this a viable alternative to evolutionary biology?
Well, I suppose that you might think it was an alternative if you thought that creationism and the theory of evolution were like two brands of toothpaste. They both, while tasting different, did the same job, clean your teeth. Unfortunately, this is not so. Creation science predicts, describes, and explains very little in the living world, and I'm afraid is better viewed as an attempt to get religion taught in school rather than a genuine and serious attempt to understand the phenomena of biology.
Could you give an example? In what way does it not give an adequate explanation or understanding of biological phenomena?
This is quite simple. The young Earth creationists insist that along with representatives of all the living species of animals today, there were representatives of dinosaur species as well on Noah's Ark. We call the study of this archaeology, and we spell it with a K to indicate that the Ark is the issue. Noah's Ark had one door. They were loaded in a week. Just to get the living species on board, they'd have to be entering the Ark at the rate of 30 per second. Once you add the dinosaur species in, the rate goes much faster. Then you've got to ask yourself how big the Ark would be. Scripture says 450 feet. With all the dinosaurs there, along with food for a year for all representatives of the species, the Ark would have to be orders of magnitude larger than the aircraft carrier the USS Nimitz. The only thing that can be said in favor of this theory is it would explain the absence of the cedars in Lebanon.
Okay. Because they were used to make the ship.
And I might also add that the largest wooden ships that we've ever made were 300 feet. They had to be reinforced with iron straps, and they had to be constantly pumped. Anything larger would undoubtedly have had structural problems of a more serious magnitude.
Okay. Are there other examples you think of the failures of creationist explanation?
Well, if we look at living mammals today, most of them, we find fossil remains going as far back as, say, 1.6 million years. If we look at the dinosaurs, we don't find many large dinosaurs beyond the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary at around 65 million years. Now, the question is this. If dinosaurs and these other animals live together, the issue becomes a simple one of the fossil record. Why don't we find large mammals and dinosaurs heterogeneously mixed in the fossil record? Evolution would lead us to expect a gap between fossilized forms of living mammals today and the fossils of the extinct dinosaurs, and the gap we see. But if the flood story was true, that they were all wiped out in the course of a year, you'd expect them to be heterogeneously mixed. And that we don't see. So I'm afraid that where creationism is the issue, the fossils say no.
Okay. One last question, which I think is a ticklish question for a number of people. It's certainly one that I've heard discussed. Is that individuals are going to be reluctant, some individuals are reluctant to embrace the theory of evolution because they think the theory of evolution cannot explain or even permit morality. And therefore, they think by allowing or permitting the teaching of evolution, they're allowing their kids to be taught that there's no such thing as morality. Does evolution preclude an understanding of morality?
Absolutely not. I'm always amazed when I hear this. Evolutionary biology gives us a description of our biology. It's a biological theory. It neither rules in nor rules out questions about what we should do, how we ought to behave. I can assure you that most criminals on our streets today do not spend their nights studying the origin of species. Jeffrey Dahmer, the serial killer, did not spend his time reading The Origin of Species. Evolution's job is not to provide an account of morality, any more than Einstein's theory of relativity is supposed to provide an account of morality. In my view, morality begins at home, not in the science laboratory. And that's as it should be, because questions of human value are not the sorts of questions that scientific theories aim to discuss or settle.
Okay, and so by your view, since they don't aim to discuss or settle those issues, they certainly don't preclude them.
They certainly do not preclude them, absolutely not.
Okay, well, we're getting out of time. Let me go back and ask one of the questions which I've heard creationists, a criticism creationist, raise of evolutionary theory, and that concerns the claims by creationists about the age of the Earth, the age of the fossils. And as I take it, the objection is that they question the methods that evolutionists use to date fossils, again, what would you take that criticism to be, and do you think it's a telling criticism?
Well, the creationist takes the position that radiometric dating procedures are inaccurate. And this, unfortunately, involves a fairly serious misunderstanding of radiometric dating procedures. When done properly, it's an extremely accurate means of determining the age of rocks. One has to be very careful. And so radiometric dating is like any other procedure. If it's not done properly, you will get misleading results. But when done properly, it's quite reliable. There are uncertainties. I'm going to be frank with you. We estimate that they're between 5 and 10% for some types of procedure. Let's assume that those uncertainties are 20%, will double the error bars here. That still leaves you with a universe that's billions of years old. If it's 4.5 billion by our radiometric dating procedure, and we've got a 20% inaccuracy, we have a universe that is still billions of years old. That sort of inaccuracy cannot be used to support the claim that the universe is about 6 to 10,000 years old. To say that it is would be like saying that a 20% inaccuracy meant that we were so uncertain as to the age of a person that we couldn't tell whether they were 100 years old or a few millionths of a second old as a fetus. Totally absurd.
Okay. We're just about out of time. If an individual listener wanted to find out a little bit more about the theory of evolution, is there anything that you would suggest they might read?
I think the best thing to do is to go and read a scientific text. And the one I'd recommend is the one I use in class, which is Douglas Fatuma's Evolutionary Biology. It lays out the evidence fairly and in an unbiased manner, and a reader for or against evolution could learn an awful lot by actually picking up a textbook. If you want to find out about evolution, get it from the horse's mouth, not from, let us say, a text designed to subvert the teaching of science in our schools.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
I've been talking this evening with Neil Shanks, professor of philosophy at East Tennessee State University, and he has been explaining to us why he thinks the theory of evolution is true. This has been Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good evening.